to write called Oliver Spike. I was startled at the revulsion that flashed into her eyes, and for a moment I thought I must have said Harlan's name, but she only said mildly that Oliver Spike had recently won an important literary prize, but that she didn't much like his work. Of course I asked why. "It is unnecessarily cruel," she said. "What about a poet called Sabra?" She brightened. "Her work is marvellous. I read it when I was at university. I remember that it made me literally tremble with delight. She had a way of conveying ordinary life as if it were astonishingly beautiful. She made you see that a blade of grass was no less beautiful and complex, no less vital, than a human being or a deliberate work of art." She laughed. "You could say she's one of the reasons I became a teacher. I was fascinated by the power of her words to move and thrill me." "Why did she stop writing poetry?" I asked. "No one knows, because when she retired, she declined to give interviews. But how is it that you came across her?" I mumbled that someone had mentioned her to me, and I'd become curious. "If you're interested, I can lend you one of her books. It's very precious to me and irreplaceable, because her work's out of print now, but I think it'd be safe in your hands." I told her I would love to borrow the book, and she promised to bring it to class Monday. Then other kids started arriving, so she left. Sylvia Yarrow was in class for the first time since what had happened in the locker hall, but she seemed pale and composed, and she didn't look at me. Maybe she had ended up getting some counselling. Jezebel Astor sat next to me, saying her sister had mentioned I'd been in the magazine office. "Was I thinking of joining the committee?" she asked. I hedged, enjoying her spicy scent as much as her wit. Towards the end of class, she finished taking notes from the board before me and most of the rest of the class and started doodling. When I had finished, I glanced over and was startled to see that she was doodling a perfect copy of the swastika and snakes that I had seen on the wall of the bus shelter. 29. "What doodle?" Jezebel stared at me, uncomprehending. We were in the hallway after the class, me keeping a wary eye out for Harlan. "I told you, you drew it right at the end of history, after we'd taken down those notes from the board. A swastika and some snakes, you must remember." "I don't know what doodle you're talking about," Jezebel insisted. "Give me your history book and I'll show you." She sighed and decanted her books onto a windowsill. I grabbed the notebook and flipped through until I reached the page. "There." She gazed at the drawing with a startled expression. "Jesus, how gross. I don't even remember doing it. But so what? You think it means I have secret Nazi tendencies?" "Don't even joke about it," I said. We had done a history assignment the year before on the Holocaust, and it had made an indelible impression on me. "I wasn't really joking," Jezebel said. "I just meant doodles can be reflections of your subconscious, but they can also just be doodles." "I'm not saying anything about your subconscious. In fact, it's not a swastika, because the arms go the wrong way. It's some sort of eternal energy symbol. I was just wondering where you saw it." "I don't know. I mean, I feel like I did see it somewhere, but I don't remember where. You know how images sneak into your mind like advertising jingles? But why are you asking me about it?" "I saw it in a bus stop, and some woman told me it was the symbol some gang used," I said. She shrugged. "Maybe I saw it in the bus stop too." That night, Ricky brought over a movie to watch. It was a pretty impressive effort, because he had to lug over a TV and a DVD player to play the movie on. It was about two extremely stupid men searching for some valuable artifact, but I couldn't seem to get the cleverness that Ricky claimed it showed. Halfway through, I drifted to the kitchen to do the dishes, so Dow wouldn't come home to a mountain of them. I was restless, because I was actually just waiting for him to come home and prove to me that he hadn't been hurt or changed by working for Aaron Race. Ricky had also brought his dog over, a dog he had saved from death, as he often told people, usually after Nelson, named for Nelson Mandela, had chewed a shoe or some other item of clothing to pieces. Nelson had been relegated to the kitchen after having tried to eat the arm of the sofa, and now he was watching me fill the sink and giving off a strong pea soup scent, which communicated wistful longing. "What do you want? Food?" I asked, and also thought at him. Nelson tilted his head and gave off an incense smell, which I understood as expressing astonishment at the clarity of my question, and a mint smell that expressed cautious hope. I laughed aloud and repeated my question. This time he responded promptly with the smell of the garden outside. All right, but don't run away, I thought firmly, and opened the front door to let him out. The night air was enticing, so I followed him out and gazed up at the stars. They were diamond bright in the moonless night. Nelson began to growl and give off a distinct gunpowder scent of warning. I looked out into the street, where pools of bluish light lit a line of cars parked by the gutter. Beyond them, a figure was coming along the street. I watched until the figure became serenity, her eyes dark-shadowed and tired. She reached the gate before she spotted me. Then her preoccupation became instant hostility. "What are you doing?" she demanded. "Letting the dog have a pee," I said, with mild coarseness. "Library again?" She glared at me. "None of your business." She looked down at Nelson, who was standing on the path between us. I noticed that he was not wagging his tail. "Get that great brute out of my way," she said coldly. "He's Ricky's. At least he came with Ricky. Get it out of my way," she said coldly. "Is something wrong?" I asked, as mildly as I could. She sliced a look at me, and the contempt in her eyes shocked me with its intensity. "You don't get it, do you? Being in this family is an accident, nothing more. There's no reason I should feel anything for you just because you're my sister, and I despise it that you can worry about me, yet not give a shit about people all over the world who are starving and dying and desperate. You can't choose to care about people who really need to be cared about. And when you do decide to sit up and care about someone who isn't from your family or your country, you feel it so deeply that when she and her family disappear, you just go on with your life. People like you make me sick. What would it take to wake you up to how pointless your life is?" "I didn't just forget about Aya, Serenity. I am Sybil," Serenity gritted out between clenched teeth. She turned and went inside. I stood there staring at the closed door with my mouth open, feeling as if she'd spat into my face. Only then did I notice that Nelson was growling deep in his throat again, his face turned to the door through which Serenity had just gone. I spent the first half of Saturday babysitting Luke, cooking pumpkin scones and making yellow Play-Doh, trying to keep the activities separate, as well as worry about Serenity and Da. He had left a message on the answering service saying he would not be back until late that night. Serenity was still in bed. I didn't know whether to be glad or not. I didn't want to face her, but at the same time, the things she had said the night before seemed to confirm that what had happened to Aya was at the heart of her anger, so maybe I should talk to her. But what could I say? I couldn't get out of my mind how Nelson had growled at her. But when I tried to get him to tell me why, he'd only offered me a watered-down version of Serenity's licorice scent, as if this were the answer. I gave some of the Play-Doh to Luke, but he was too little to do much more than squish it and try to eat it, so I had to keep an eye on him, as well as the food. It was all a bit of a balancing act, especially since, for some reason, Nelson had stayed over, even though Ricky and Miranda had gone out. I had tried to have another conversation with the dog, but he had not seemed to want it. In fact, his attention was on Luke, and I had to keep pushing him away so that Luke would not grab an enthusiastic handful of his rather loose and floppy face. "Don't worry," Nelson's sense assured me after the third time. "He smells good, but I won't eat him." By the time Mum returned with Jessie, who had driven her to meet Rona at the gallery where she was to have her show, I was ready to go. I handed Luke over and set off for the moor, determined to listen to Angel Blue at the music shop before I caught the bus to meet Jilly at the Marceau. I wanted to see if Angel Blue's work had taken the same turn as Oliver Spike's and Dowd Raphael's, becoming harder, colder, less hopeful. I still had no idea why or how this could be Aaron Race's doing, but there was a definite pattern. It was cloudy and looked like it might rain, but I walked anyway. Unfortunately, the music store didn't have any Angel Blue CDs in stock, but the older woman behind the counter told me she was grim, for all the kids loved her. All that gloom and doom and life's shit and then you die, which was as good as saying Mallory Hart had changed for the worse after getting tangled up with Aaron Race. Oddly, I felt reassured by this, Because if Aaron Race was making people change by hardening them and turning them cynical, he had picked the wrong person in Da. Just as I got to the hotel, it started raining hard, and I was congratulating myself on my luck until I got inside, and the receptionist handed me a note from Jilly, asking me to meet her in a cafe a few streets away. I thanked the receptionist and went back outside, sighing, because now it was not only raining, I could hear the distant rumble of thunder. There was nothing but to make a run for it, and 15 minutes later I arrived at Medusa's tea room, drenched to the skin. A bell tinged delicately as I entered the cafe, which had low coffee tables, surrounded by a lot of mismatched but comfortable armchairs and sofas, all covered in lurid purple plush. There were no other customers, and an open fire made it just about perfect. The woman behind the counter noticed me and looked horrified. I promised hastily to stand in front of the fire and dry before I sat on her cushions. "Oh, it's not the cushions I'm worrying about, dearie," she said kindly. "You'll catch cold if you stay wet through like that. I'll get you a towel." When she brought it, I dried my hair and arms and face gratefully and pressed some of the wetness out of my clothes. The woman then made me sit close to the fire on a stool and insisted on bringing me hot buttered crumpets and tea. The funny thing was that her essence also smelled of crumpets. I panicked a bit when I saw the lovely silver tray with the delicate white china set and pretty doilies, but a hasty examination of the menu calmed me because I could afford to pay. I was pretty impressed by her kindness to a bedraggled teenager. Most adults seem to me to see any teenager as a walking time bomb waiting to explode. When the fire got too hot and my clothes were sending out plumes of steam, I shifted to a seat by the window and sat contentedly watching people running by with sodden newspapers tented over their heads until Jilly arrived. "Sorry I'm late," she said, hugging me and then grimacing at my dampness. She had an umbrella, of course. "How's your grandmother?" The note had said Jilly was going to the doctor with her grandmother and would be dropped off after at the tea shop. "She's just a bit shaken still," Jilly said. The woman who owned the cafe came over, and Jilly ordered crumpets and said we should both have hot chocolates. I protested, but she said I must have one, because drinking hot chocolate alone was like drinking alcohol alone, and it was her treat. Then she asked how school had gone, and I told her that I had managed to avoid Harlan the whole day. As we drank the chocolate and she ate her crumpets, I told her what I had learned about Angel Blue, Dowd Raphael, Zabra, and Oliver Spike. It was hearing that Mum had known Oliver Spike before he had become famous that really got her attention. "Let's just call him," she said eagerly, pulling out a mobile phone. She tapped in the number for information and gave them his name before I could stop her. I mouthed that he was famous and wouldn't be listed, and she mouthed back that you never knew. I shrugged, thinking that if she got the number, I would just tell her I didn't want to talk. But to my horror, a moment later she was asking if she was speaking to Oliver Spike. Too late, I realized she must have dialed Call Connect, and he'd been listed. Worse, before I could get the receiver from her, she told him my name and said my mother knew him. I grabbed the phone from her, terrified she would mention Aaron Race as well. "Zambia White Star," Oliver Spike was saying in a flat, limp voice. "I don't know the name. Was that her maiden name?" My danger sense was going absolutely crazy. "I think I've made a mistake," I stammered, hoping he wouldn't notice the change of voice. "Zambia. Wait, there was a girl at university," Oliver Spike went on in his weary, wintry voice. "What was your name?" My danger sense was reacting so strongly now that I was feeling sick. "Forget it," I said, and thought as hard as I could. "Forget this call. Forget the names. It was a wrong number." "A wrong number," Oliver Spike said, sounding confused. I could hardly believe I had done it again, and over the phone. I was about to hang up when it occurred to me he might have caller ID. "It was a wrong number," I thought again, very deliberately. "It's a nuisance. Erase the number." "Just be more careful," Oliver Spike said after a moment. "It's a nuisance because now I'll have to erase this number." There was a click as he hung up. I handed the phone back to Jilly, who was staring at me in complete bewilderment. "What happened? You changed colour about 10 times on the phone. And what on earth were you saying about a wrong number? I gave him your name." I could not speak. I was still reeling from having somehow made Oliver Spike do what I wanted by thinking at him over the phone. "That was weird," Jilly persisted. "I just felt I shouldn't be talking to him," I said, inadequately. Thunder cracked loudly, and a flash of lightning lit the room. "Storm must be right overhead," Jilly said quietly, as if speaking loudly would attract its wrath. Harrison burst in through the door. "Come on, you two. I've got a taxi waiting. If we didn't take it, there'll be an hour's wait for another in this." He paid hastily, and I was glad of the bustle because it stopped me thinking about what had happened on the phone. The figure on the meter made me sick all over again, but in a less eerie way. I would just have to swallow my pride and ask Jilly if I could owe her. But as the taxi sped through the Rain Street city, Jilly announced that she would pay because her gran had given her the money expressly. Harrison began to argue, saying he'd pay for his bit, but then he glanced at me and suddenly gave in. I was startled to find his essence scent infused with lavender. I had no idea what it meant, of course, and I wasn't about to ask and have them start feeling self-conscious about my extended senses. Once the question of who would pay had been resolved, Harrison began to tell us about Sari's removal to Bellevue. He had called her already, and she was deliriously happy, saying it was the most beautiful place she'd ever been, and she couldn't wait for the weather to get better so she could go outside. At last the taxi pulled up out the front of a stone church. I couldn't see the houses either side, because it was raining harder than ever, but when the taxi door opened, Jilly tumbled out and ran up the walkway to the church door. Harrison did the same, and when I saw him hammer at the door, I gaped.
"You planning to set up house or what?" the driver grumbled.
I mumbled an apology, got out, and did my own splashing dash to join the others. The immense wooden door to the church opened as I reached the top of the wide stone ramp leading to the entrance, and there was Raoul in his wheelchair, looking more casual than I'd ever seen him, barefoot in jeans and a dark, thin jumper. Behind him was a wide, pale hallway with a very high roof and low wall lighting, stretching away to the rear of what I now realized must be a renovated and privately owned church. For a long, startled minute, I had actually thought Raoul might be one of those priests that didn't wear any sort of uniform. We entered, our footsteps instantly swallowed by the muffling softness of thick, dove-grey carpet. The door swished closed and cut off the sound of rain and the storm as Raoul led us down the corridor, past a series of black-and-white photographs showing blown-up details of stonework that I guess were bits of this very building before it had been altered. Raoul stopped by the door to an enormous gleaming white and sea-glass-green bathroom and invited us to dry off. Harrison got towels from a cupboard with the ease of familiarity, and Jilly took a hairdryer out of a drawer. 10 minutes later we were all dry, if tousled, and Raoul asked if we were hungry. When we shook our heads, he wheeled the rest of the way down the hall to what he told me was his computer room. When the door at the end of the hall swung open, I gasped, because we had come to a vast room that took up the entire back portion of the church. The roof was very high and sharply angled, and there were stained glass window inserts that must be original on either side, transforming the dulled light of the day into jewel-bright smears of yellow and crimson and glowing indigo on the polished floorboards. The entire back wall of the house was glass and looked out onto what appeared to be a minor jungle inside a huge greenhouse. The glass roof of the greenhouse was a smooth extension of the roofline of the church, and I gazed in wonder through 2 layers of glass at the sky where soundless lightning flashed and forked in a bruised dark sky. Raoul's wheelchair gave its soft hydraulic hum, and I turned to see there was a bench running right along the wall through which we had entered, from the door to the side wall. It was laden with more electronic equipment than I had ever seen in my entire life, even in a store. There were at least 6 computer screens with keyboards, not to mention more than 9 cameras, a movie camera on a tripod, a scanner, a DVD player, amplifiers, recording equipment that would have made Neil's mouth water, and 100 other boxes and bits of stuff that I couldn't even identify. Under the bench, there were shelves stacked with thousands of CDs and DVDs and dozens of books. Raoul had installed himself at the bench, where there was a gap, and he was booting up a computer. Harrison grinned at me, acknowledging my wide-eyed wonder. He and Jilly opened a door in the side wall and brought out three folding chairs, arranging them around Raoul. I sat down, still lost for words, but no longer startled at the idea that Raoul would pay for Sari's expensive convalescent home or have a specially modified car. Jilly's grandmother was well off, but Raoul's wealth was of another order entirely. Raoul now said, "Before we do anything else, I just wanted to show you this." We watched silently as the screen came to life, revealing four boxes containing enigmatic lines of text. "You've got deeper," I guessed, my heartbeat quickening. I felt Harrison and Jilly stir as they realized what they were looking at. Raoul shook his head. "Well, that's the interesting thing. I haven't. I've never come across such complex protections, but what I have been able to figure out is that to go any deeper into the program, you have to have certain code words and numbers. That means no one is meant to enter it, but those for whom it was created. Now, companies do this all the time, for the sake of privacy, but why would a website open to the public work in this way? Could it be for secret agents who might have to link in from an internet cafe?" Jilly asked. She flushed and laughed when we all looked at her, saying she had spies on the brain because she'd watched an espionage movie on television the night before. But Raoul said she might be right, though I doubt it would be political spies. "It is more likely to be connected to industrial espionage. I can't think what else it would be unless this Aaron Race is some sort of master criminal, in which case, from what you've said, he's following in the fine tradition of crooks who love to hobnob with stars." "You think he's a criminal, then?" I asked, disappointed, because I couldn't see any way to fit this in with the pattern of how artists changed after becoming involved with him. "All I'm saying is that he has something to hide," Raoul said. Jilly interrupted to urge me to tell them what had happened when I used her phone to speak to Oliver Spike. "You felt endangered by talking to him?" Raoul asked me. I just felt this really strong sense of danger because Jilly had mentioned my name to him. I think it was because he might mention it to Aaron Race, who would straightaway think of Da. Jilly's face fell. "Oh, God, I didn't even think. I'm so sorry." "It's okay," I said. "He won't remember." "But what if he does?" Jilly asked worriedly. "He won't. I know." Harrison was watching me closely. "You know," he repeated. I bit my lip, then I said, "I know because I made him forget the whole conversation." 30. "It's something else I can do that I didn't get to tell you the other night at the hotel." I stopped and drew a breath to calm down. "Sometimes I can make people do what I want just by willing it, by saying the words with my mind. What I figured out is that when we think things, we give off scents that I can smell. And just as my senses have changed so that I can smell better, I can now also shape smells by thinking. Twice I've willed people to forget things, and both times it worked. But it doesn't work all the time, so I think it has something to do with the strength of the mind of the person I'm willing." "Like hypnosis," Jilly murmured, looking fascinated. "But you are on the phone to this guy," Harrison pointed out. I nodded. "I know. I only did it because I was desperate, and I've no idea how it worked. Maybe I've got this whole scent thing wrong, because I thought it was possible only when I was looking at someone." "It might be that being afraid activated some new ability," Raoul said. "The important thing is that you dealt with the danger. Figuring out how you managed it can come later." "I'm sorry I didn't tell you this before. I guess the truth is it feels kind of horrible doing it, like mental bullying." Raoul said firmly, "You were protecting yourself, that's all." "Did you ever try Will and Harlan to leave you alone?" Harrison asked. I stared at him, realizing that it had never occurred to me. But Raoul was shaking his head. "Maybe it would be better not to try that just yet. If the sickness Harlan carries is attracted to the possibility that your senses are altered, the last thing we want is to confirm it." You know, I've been thinking about Aaron Race, Jilly said, gazing at the computer screen. Your being so scared and suspicious about him would make a lot more sense if he smelled of wrongness too. But he doesn't, and anyway, it would be a bit of a coincidence that two infected people were after different members of the White Star family, I said. I just wish Dar was home, that's all. Where is he? Jilly asked. Doing another gig for Aaron Race, I said heavily. It's in Remington. Remington, Rowell said thoughtfully. I waited to see if he was going to mention Sari and the convalescent home, but instead he tapped at the keys, and in a few minutes we were looking at the same site for Castledean Estate that I had looked at in the school magazine office. It's the headquarters of Aaron Race, Inc., and it's in Remington, I explained to the other two, who'd been looking puzzled. Rowell said he had come across the site earlier that day, but he hadn't looked into it. He tapped a key, and we read that, although it was owned by Race, Inc., the majority of events staged at what was described as this extensive and lavish venue were organized by the International Charitable Organization, ORBA, which also funded the artist residency program on the estate. 3- and 6-month residencies were available to emerging and established artists from all disciplines, and application forms and guidelines were available upon request. There was a link to download the application form. I felt cold at the thought of how many bright young artists might be drawn to use the form, and what might happen to them at Castledean Estate. "Let's see what you need to get in," Rowell said, and tapped on the icon to download the form. Immediately the screen began to shudder and fizz. "What the hell?" Rowell said, because the fuzz had vanished, and now something was downloading. Then we were all staring, shocked, at a naked man. "Oh, no," Jilly said, horrified. "It's a porn site," Harrison said flatly. "This is impossible," Rowell muttered, tapping at the escape button, but the man in the image reached down to cup his genitals. Rowell tried returning to the previous page, but the camera panned relentlessly sideways to show a child. Rowell swore softly and switched the whole computer off. I stared at our ghostly reflections in the blackened computer screen and thought about the note on the computer room door at school. I chewed my lip. "Rowell, when I called up Aaron Race's website on the school computer, a creepy bondage website came up. I couldn't get it to go away either, and now there's a notice on the door of the computer room saying no one's allowed to use the internet because of a virus. And I logged into that Castledean site on a different computer, but before I could go into it, the bell rang. I bet you anything, if I had gone deeper, the same thing would have happened." "That is weird," Jilly said inadequately. Rowell said, "It sounds as if the virus was either in Aaron Race's website and migrated to the Castledean website or vice versa. But where did it originate? I'd like to look into it. Why don't you three test the game for me in the meantime?" I didn't feel the least like playing a computer game, but neither did I want to look at child porn or maybe something equally disgusting, so I agreed. Harrison and Jilly must have felt the same, because they agreed too. Rowell settled us in front of another screen and gave us joysticks and earphones that were amazingly comfortable and therefore probably amazingly expensive. Then he explained that the game offered realistic human problems in a fantasy setting, saying that it was to be a teaching tool for psychology students. I wasn't much of a games person as a rule, but it was fun playing with Harrison and Jilly, because once we got into the game, they played their roles imaginatively and with great flair. I felt like a lump of wood between Jilly and Harrison. Gilead, mistress of the flame, had a host of sometimes invisible pet salamanders and the ability to turn rock to lava, in which she could then swim. And Prince Ha was lord of Harfield City. I was Zonda, who had the amazing ability to communicate with animals, which was ironic, considering. I had not said anything about my ability to communicate with animals, because I was beginning to feel embarrassed about the things I kept revealing. By the time we had finished the game, I felt refreshed and energized. I looked at my watch and was astonished to discover we'd played for over an hour. "Dinner," Rowell said decidedly, and he wheeled ahead of us out to the kitchen. I expected to be given a boiled egg and toast or noodles,
The dinner was gourmet pizza, made expertly by Raoul in his state-of-the-art black-and-white kitchen. We all watched appreciatively. Then, when it was cooked, we carried it out and ate it at a long trestle table set up on a mosaic-covered square at the heart of the indoor jungle. It felt incredible to be eating pizza by candlelight, bare-armed, because the enormous greenhouse was heated for the tropical plants, with rain pelting softly down on the transparent roof overhead. Dessert was baked pears with rich chocolate sauce. "That was sublime," I told Raoul, when we had finished and stacked the dishes onto two trays. We hadn't talked about anything but the game during the meal, and Raoul's questions had made it clear that he really was using us to test it. But now, he asked Harrison and Jilly if they would carry in the trays and load the dishwasher. They both glanced at me before obediently taking a tray each and going inside. Left alone in the shadowy garden, I looked nervously at Raoul, wondering what he wanted to say to me. "There is now a virus in my computer system, and it looks as if it has affected all of my terminals since they're all networked," he said. "So far as I can make out, the virus causes random links with porn or bondage or other similar sites, then freezes a system so the link can't be broken. If you switch the computer off, the link is immediately re-established when it is switched on again."
"Oh, I'm so sorry," I said contritely. "If I hadn't asked you to help me, this wouldn't have happened."
"You're not responsible for a virus," Raoul said dismissively. "But I want to know how it got through my firewall and virus protection. To track it and to clean up my system, I will need to call in some expert help. By expert, I mean a hacker. I'd like to see if she can also get some more information about Aaron Race. How do you feel about that?"
I knew he meant, how did my danger sense feel about it? "I think it would be better if Aaron Race doesn't know anyone is interested in him," I said slowly, wishing I could just tell him what Gary Solomon had said. The truth was, I was beginning to resent the promise that he had exacted, because it was making it hard for me to protect my friends.
Raoul nodded. "You needn't worry about Daisy on that count. She's fanatically careful. The other thing I'd like to do is call into the headquarters of Orba. If you remember, that's the organization that runs those events at Castledean Estate. I want to see how they're tied up with Race Inc. I've looked up their offices, and they're in Remington as well, so I can just call in when I visit Sarri next Tuesday."
I licked my lips, thinking I had to warn him. "Raoul, I want to tell you something about Aaron Race, but I made a promise."
"Promises ought to be kept," Raoul said simply.
"I know, and I am keeping it, but I have to tell you that someone warned me that it could be dangerous to be caught prying into Aaron Race's business."
"This person who warned you, are they a friend?"
I shook my head. "Just someone I met while I was trying to find out more."
"Well, you needn't worry. I won't mention you or Aaron Race. In fact, I will present myself as a possible future donor."
I bit my lip and said, "Raoul, why are you going to so much trouble to help me find out about Aaron Race?"
He smiled. "Partly it's because what I've learned has made me curious. But the main reason is because your senses are reacting to him, and I want to know why. I've thought a lot since we talked at the hotel, and I can't help but feel excited about the possibilities of your enhanced senses. It seems to me that this wrongness, this sickness, could be responsible for much of man's inhumanity to man and beast. Imagine if all cruelty and ugliness came down to this sickness. That means humanity might be capable of being healed, if we could learn enough about it."
"But Aaron Race
isn't infected," Raoul completed my sentence. "But you think there is something wrong with him, and given what else your senses perceive, I mean to find out what it is about him that makes you so uneasy."
Harrison and Jilly had come back, and Harrison said, "I have to say, I feel pretty much the same way as Raoul, but I think our first priority has to be to protect you from the sickness, that is, from Harlan Sanderson."
"I wonder what happens to someone like Harlan," Jilly said. "I mean, if Sarri doesn't get any worse because she's resisting the wrongness, and that's why you can't smell her."
"Maybe you can smell Harlan because he isn't resisting. But what happens to him now? Does he get sicker or what?"
Harrison and Raoul exchanged a look of speculation. It makes sense that a sick person could get sicker, but in this case, what is sicker? Harrison mused.
I was thinking he might end up knowing what he carried, Jilly continued. Maybe once a person is infected enough, the disease wouldn't care any more about the host knowing, because they'd be too far gone to resist it.
That could be another stage, Raoul said. A person who was infected and knew it, and who wanted to infect other people, would be a good deal more effective than an ignorant carrier, because they would be capable of using all of their human intelligence to do what the sickness wanted.
He stretched, and the movement made me realize how stiff I had become. I was also feeling strange because of what he had said about sickness being behind the awful things that people had done in the world. That would mean hundreds of people might be infected, and not just in our time. I said that I had better go, and Raoul suggested we all have a hot drink in the kitchen before heading our separate ways. As Jilly boiled the kettle and Harrison and I assembled cups, I finally asked Jilly what had happened the previous day with her grandmother and the police.
Not all that much. A neighbour saw two guys hanging around the place, but the police wouldn't say who the neighbour was. They just wanted to know if Gran remembers seeing the guys since the fire. Apparently people who burn or vandalise places often return to the scene of the crime. The weird thing is that when they were reading out the neighbour's description of the guys, I had the feeling I'd seen them, only it couldn't be since the fire because we haven't been near the house.
How did the neighbour describe the guys? I asked, sipping the froth off my coffee.
One was a skinhead. The other might have been too, but he was wearing a hoodie. Anyway, the police reckon they're part of a gang who've torched a whole lot of different places.
That snagged on something, but the doorbell rang. It was Jessie, and I had to go before I could drag it out of the depths of my mind.
What's up? Jessie asked curiously. We were halfway home, and I realized that I hadn't said more than two words the whole way. I looked at his handsome round face, lit by the ghastly blue-green light from the console panel.
Jessie, what if you had the power to help humanity change for the better? Would you feel like you ought to do it?
It depends.
On what?
On lots of things. On what I had to do to make them change, for one. I mean, if you said I had to run over some kid or he grew up to be a monster and kill a whole lot of people, I'd say no. But if you said I had to stand by a dike and stick my finger in it to save a village, even though the whole bank might break open and kill me, I hope I'd say yes. But it's also the old power question in disguise, isn't it? Jessie asked.
Power? I echoed, puzzled.
He shrugged. Well, if you have power and use it, and power inevitably corrupts, then by using your power, you would be allowing yourself to be corrupted. But would the corruption be worse than the harm you could prevent?
So it would be better not to act, is that what you're saying? I asked.
Sometimes it's better not to act, Jessie said. In fact, I'd say it's mostly better not to act, but sometimes there's no choice.
He flicked me a look.
It must have been some video game you were playing tonight.
That made me laugh, and some of my tension dissolved.
Do you think power always corrupts if it's used? Might there not be a way to act and not be corrupted? Let's say you have some trusted advisers, and you listen to them. A devil's advocate would say then they have power and would be corrupted by it, to the extent of the power you gave them.
I sighed. So there's no way to use power for good?
Well, I don't think you can make a rule. I think you'd have to decide these things in the moment, on a case-by-case basis.
Wouldn't you still be corrupted?
Well, there's always the danger. But I think if you try to stay specific and are aware of the danger and make your goals humble, and never let yourself get really sure or certain about anything, and also if you have trusted friends whose advice you listen to, then you're less likely to be corrupted.
31. On Sunday, I was in the lounge room doing homework when Jessie came in and asked me to tell Serenity she had to go to the shop and get something he needed. He was babysitting Luke, and weekend Luke sitters were always designated a gopher for the day. Today it was Serenity, but if I hadn't been in the middle of a train of thought in an essay, I might have offered to go instead. As it was, I was only irritated slightly at having to run upstairs. I padded barefoot up the stairs, trying to think what I had done with the list of points Mrs. Barker had wanted us to use when we redid our essays. I was still inside my own mind, rummaging, when I pushed open the bedroom door and saw Serenity on her knees by the bed. My first absurd thought was that she was praying. Then I realized she was pushing something under the bed. Then the door creaked a little, and she spun around. "You're always spying on me," she snapped. "Why don't you just leave me alone?" "I wasn't," I said indignantly. "In case you've forgotten, this is my bedroom too. But I only came in to tell you that Jessie wants something down at the shops." Serenity's eyes blazed with a loathing that shocked me and made me step aside. She stalked past, leaving me enveloped in a waft of licorice and burning hair. Shaken, I resolved to tell Da that I thought she needed help. I heard the front door slam and crossed to the window to watch her go out the gate and up the street, a string shopping bag dangling from her hand. Turning away from the window, my gaze fell on her bed, and without thinking, I crossed the room and knelt down to look under it. All I saw was a thin book with a yellow cover. I pulled it out. The title of the book, in plain black text, was The Way. From its size, it was a poetry book. The first page had a list of what I thought must be poems, only when I ran my eye down them, they didn't sound very much like poetry. The first one said, "The Way to Proceed," and turned out to be a chapter heading. The chapter began by saying that it was impossible to know one's true path if one's life was full of attachments. "The first step in learning one's path," it went on, "is to divest oneself of connections to humans and to material things. Only then is one truly naked in body and soul." The language reminded me a bit of the stuff I'd read about the Bushi, and as I read on, it seemed to me that this was a kind of code, too. The next chapter was titled, "The Poetics of Thought and Action." "Racy," I thought, with a jab of humour. But at the same time, I crossed to the window to keep an eye out for Serenity, knowing she would be incandescent if she caught me snooping. I did feel guilty, but my curiosity overrode it. "To act is an expression of thought," the book said. "To act on an ideal is to live an ideal, rather than merely talking and thinking about it. Courage is shown when we act upon our thoughts. Courage is making thought a reality. An ideal which is not acted upon is nothing. It is less than nothing, because it is a hollow thought with no intent. Those who profess ideals and do not act upon them are cowards and deceivers." The last sentence jolted me a bit, because it was the sort of thing Serenity had been saying, and it had the same venom I had seen in her eyes as she had stormed from the room. I flicked through the book, reading a sentence here and there, and finding more of the same oddly religious-sounding philosophy with an occasional unexpectedly sharp, accusatory passage. Then I came to a bit that struck me as having a different tone from what had gone before. I went back a little and read it more slowly. "There are some situations that demand action from any human being who encounters them or learns of them. That we do not act is our shame. Those who watch and do nothing while evil is allowed to exist and operate are more guilty than those who commit the evil. History is full of the cowardice and indifference of these watchers who did nothing. They are the dogs that did not bark, and they prospered by their silence and bred more of their kind, who see nothing and hear nothing and do not speak out against evil, who feel safe and pure because they commit no action that is evil. Are you such a dog? Are you one who sees evil and does not protest against it? Are you one who watches as nations slaughter one another and then turn cold-eyed to your favorite television program? Do you see the obscenely wealthy spend billions of dollars on clothes and jewelry and retaining their youth while thousands of children die agonizing deaths for want of food or clean water or shelter and feel no desire to protest?" Somewhere in the house a door banged, and I gave a start and nervously looked down into the street, but there was no sign of Serenity. There was another bang, and I guess she must have left the screen door unlatched when she went out, and it was banging in the wind. I knew I ought to put the book back before I was caught, but I suddenly felt certain that this strange, fervid little book was an important clue about what was happening to Serenity. I turned to the last chapter, wanting to get some sense of what the book was leading to. The chapter heading was commitment. A coldness crept through me, because hadn't the bouncer type who'd stopped Harrison going into Serenity's poetry meeting said something about commitment, and the name of the group, the Morality Complex, almost sounded like it could have been a chapter heading in the book. I read some of the last chapter. That we must protest against evil and wrongdoing, against cowardice and avarice and cruelty, is obvious to anyone who can think or feel, and who professes to be human and the bearer of a soul. But there come moments in life when we could do far more than merely protest or stand against evil. In these moments, it is possible that a single action may cause a beacon of light to blaze out, which would illuminate and inspire all who see it and change the world forever. You say that single actions do not change the course of the world. Look at history and see that it is so. A person with the courage to act in the right moment could change the world. But most people fail the test of such moments. Their vision is dim or non-existent, and their minds clouded with doubt and fear, or with inappropriate attachment to people or to material possessions. Do not fail to grasp the moments of destiny that come to you, and in which you may be a true and decisive force for change. Make your mind and spirit strong and resolute enough to reject the doubts that will rear up in your path like snakes. Commit to the moment and act, for in this moment, by acting, you reveal your deepest self. The door slammed again, and I looked out the window. No Serenity in the street, but maybe she was already in the house. Suddenly panicking, I dropped to my knees, but in trying to close the book to put it back under the bed, I managed to flip open the last page. What I saw made me freeze in disbelief, for here was the reverse swastika with snakes that I had seen in the bus shelter, and which Jezebel Astor had casually and unwittingly doodled in her English book. Only this one was not graffiti or a doodle. It was printed, and there were words under it. Beyond this point, there is only action. "How dare you touch my things!" Serenity hissed. I spun round in fright, leaving the booklet on the ground. "I was just going to pick up a book you dropped." Serenity darted across the room and snatched the small book up. "Jesus, calm down," I said, my words languid enough to belie my pounding heart. "What is it anyway, your diary?" She actually looked as if I'd hit her. The blood drained from her face, and she looked deathly ill, or terribly old, except for her eyes, which seemed to go from molten dark blue to stony black hardness. "You have no idea, do you?" she asked in a low, passionate voice. "You're like some cow in a field, chewing on its cud." "You need help, Serenity," I said. "Fuck you," she said, and walked out, closing the door behind her with contemptuous care. I stared at the closed door for a long time, shocked by her swearing. Not by the swear word itself, but by her use of it. As a family, we didn't swear. It was not forbidden, as much as regarded as dull-witted. Dar had gently drummed into us that a person with a good vocabulary could say anything and everything with great precision and emphasis. A swear word was like throwing a lump of dung at someone by comparison. It might connect, but it was dull and imprecise, and you got dirty using it. I had grown up, as we all had, to see swearing as a form of stupidity. But something more frightening than stupidity was going on. What did it mean that Serenity had a book with a swastika in it that was supposed to be the emblem of some violent gang in Shaletown? And what had the book to do with the poetry group at the library? Because I was certain that was where she'd got it. Dust still hadn't returned by dinner time, so we ate his celebration dinner without him, me, Jesse, Serenity, and Miranda, who'd made pumpkin ravioli stuffed with spinach and ricotta cheese. I barely tasted the food. I was desperate for Dar to come home, not just because I wanted to see he was safe, but because I had to talk to him about Serenity. I had expected to smell rage on her when she came down to eat, but her face was wiped clean of all emotion. Her thin pretense of eating seemed to come from habit rather than from any real desire to seem normal. I wondered yet again why she had reacted so violently to the idea of my looking at the book. Anyone would think it was a diary. Serenity suddenly got up, scraped the food into the chook bowl, and went out. I didn't go after her, because I was determined not to go to bed until I'd spoken to Da. But it got later and later, and my thoughts swung from worrying about Serenity to worrying about Da. I kept picturing the fierce solemnity in Gary Solomon's face when he had told me that Aaron Race was bad news for artists, and the stuff I had read online only confirmed that he was telling the truth. I had to go and see him again, I decided. I had to explain that I needed to be able to tell my friends what he had said about Race in order to stop them from doing something dangerous. Maybe, while I was with him, I could also mention the gang in Shale Town that used the snake and reverse swastika symbol to see if it heard anything that might explain its connection to Serenity's poetry group. Close to 11, Mum drifted into the room, looking fresh and alert. She kissed my cheek and said, "They'll be here before morning," just as if she read my mind. "Mum," I said, hardly able to believe I was going to say it, "I'm worried about Serenity." She nodded, and the movement sent her glorious red curls tumbling softly about her shoulders. "I'm thinking of painting her, my darling." I felt a surge of anger towards her. I wanted to scream at her to pay attention to the real world for once, instead of only ever seeing it in terms of her paintings. There were things going on that needed taking care of, and people, Da and Serenity, and me too, maybe. I wanted to ask what kind of mother she was, if you could never have a proper conversation with her. What good, I wanted to rage, was all that beauty and talent to us? My brief fury faded, because what would have been the use of my rant? Mum would probably have just suggested painting me. She touched my cheek as she went out, and I saw a fleeting vision of flames that frightened me until I realized they were only painted. I went up to my room, feeling depressed and anxious. Serenity was already in bed, of course, and turning to face her humped form, I focused my hearing on her breathing and heartbeat to reassure myself that she was asleep. But it was a long time before I slept. Madness, I thought, and realized that it was the first time I had allowed myself to think the word. And yet, it was what I had seen in Serenity's face when she snatched the book from me earlier. Madness or something very close to it. And the book and the so-called poetry group were somehow responsible. "A pretty weird sort of poetry club," Harrison had said after following Serenity that night, and I cursed myself for wallowing in relief instead of realizing that he was right. What sort of poetry group had tough-looking skinheads minding the door? What sort of poetry group demanded commitment to ideals from its members? That night, I dreamed of myself as a wolf, but for the first time, I felt myself hunted, or at least watched by hidden, malevolent eyes. And for the first time, the unease I had occasionally felt during the wolf dreams coalesced into the distinct feeling that time was running out. Time for what? I thought. Then I remembered Da, and hastened out of bed, with fear drubbing through me, to find out if he was home. He wasn't in the kitchen, as he usually was, having a cup of tea in stained sweat clothes after his morning run, and my heart sank. Then I saw Serenity in her school uniform, standing by the window and staring out. "Serenity, is Da home?" I asked. She turned and looked at me as she calmly picked up her bag and went out the door. Only then did I spot the note propped against the toaster. I tore it open and read that he was sorry he had not got home early enough for what looked to have been a memorable welcome home dinner, that we shouldn't wake him for at least 100 years, whereupon we were to have shaving cream and a razor at the ready. It was so Da that I laughed aloud, and suddenly all my dark imaginings seemed absurd. What an idiot I was. Of course nothing could change Da. Jesse wandered in, read the note with a grin, and then examined the fridge with an air of stoic disappointment. "No food," he sighed. "Honestly, Mum's forgotten to shop again." There was no cereal or toast either, but I excavated an English muffin from the back of the bread tin that had only a couple of mould spots, toasted it, then ate it at the counter, finishing the math sheet I hadn't been able to focus on the night before. When I was finished, I slung my backpack over one shoulder and called goodbye to Mum. He'd just come into the kitchen, yawning and carrying a gurgling and wide-awake Luke. On the bus, I remembered my plan to talk to Da about Serenity. Of course, I couldn't tell him what Harrison had learned by following her, nor about the yellow book, but he had said enough over the last weeks for me to think he was pretty concerned about her too, though he wasn't making a big thing of it. I went back to thinking about the yellow book. To begin with, the statements in it had seemed strident but plausible. People ought to act on their ideals and stand up for what they believed in, and it was true that some of the most terrible things in the world had only been able to happen because good people stood back and did nothing. But there had been something ugly under the words, a sense that someone was being blamed, a hectoring accusation that erupted only occasionally into the open with vicious diatribes against those who failed to act. Was that the aim of the harangue? That a reader should prepare herself to act? But to act how? Harrison had said the thug who stopped him going to the meeting room at the library had spoken of the need to prove his commitment. But prove it how? And commitment to what? It was like there was a haze of pompous and impressive words obscuring something harder and more sinister, and it was connected to Serenity. The bus pulled up at the school stop, and I hung back to avoid being jostled by a couple of Year 9 boys trying to see who could punch the hardest as they got out. These were the sort of kids a gang ought to be recruiting, I thought. What use would a gang have for a reclusive, troubled girl like Serenity with her pacifist ideals? She would be more likely someone they'd choose for a victim. I could feel Harlan's eyes boring into my back as we did a term test in English, and I felt sure he would say something after the class about me avoiding him. I knew I should stay around and diffuse his anger by letting him corner me, maybe even agree to another meeting somewhere very public. But I was in too much of a turmoil about Serenity. If I could, I would evade him again. There were three essay choices, and I was relieved to see that one focused on the lonely passion of Judith Hearne. I settled to work and didn't stop until 40 minutes later, when Mrs. Barker said we should hand our papers in as we went out of the class. As we lined up to give the papers in, Jilly whispered into my ear that Sylvia Yarrow had left school. I turned to stare at her, and she nodded solemnly. Why? No one knows. I heard some kids talking about it before you got here. We fell silent as we got to Mrs. Barker, and she smiled briefly as she took our papers. As we left the classroom, me hustling Jilly so we'd be out of sight by the time Harlan got out, she asked if Da had got home safely. He came late last night, I said, getting round a corner and out of sight of the classroom door with relief. Let's go into a room, I said, as the bell rang. I have to tell you something. I glanced around, and Jilly finally twigged that I was worried about Harlan, so she looked around with blatant furtiveness that made me want to laugh in spite of everything. He found an empty room, and I led her towards a desk that could not be seen by anyone glancing in as they passed the door. I told her then about finding the book under Serenity's bed and about the swastika, and I was in the middle of telling her about the doodle in Jezebel's history book when she gave a gasp and bit her lip. "What's the matter?" I demanded. "Alison, you've just reminded me. That neighbour who saw those guys hanging around Grant's house. But it can't have any connection." "What?" "Well, the policeman said the neighbour thought they were some sort of neo-Nazis, because one of them had a swastika with yellow snakes around it, tattooed on the back of his head." I felt winded. "Do you remember anything else the police said about them?" Jilly shook her head. "The neighbour didn't get close enough to be able to describe anything in too much detail. But Alison, how could guys like that have any connection with some poetry group? It must be just that they're using the same symbol." "Maybe," I said, but I didn't believe it. Too many swastika and snake symbols. Too many shaven-headed guys. Yet there was something missing. I felt it in my bones, or maybe it was my extended senses prodding me. "What were the words?" Jilly asked. I stared at her blankly. "You said there were words under the swastika in the book." "Beyond this point, there is only action," I told her, thinking sickly of Serenity, being somehow involved in the house fire that had deprived Jilly and her gran of their home. But at the same time, it was absolutely ludicrous to imagine Serenity setting a house fire, or even approving it.
It just didn't make sense.
32. The next class was a PowerPoint presentation from a kid who read from it in such a low monotone that you had to